It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The only thing better than grinding all night for your side hustle is your roommate picking you up with Mickey D's breakfast. The perfect pickup deal.
There's a deal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, taste breakfast perfection when you get a warm and savory sausage McMuffin with egg for just $2.50. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Hello, my name is Dave Hannerty, and there will be no encore. Welcome to The Revisit, a very, very special episode of No Encore, in which we go back in time to Irish albums from a given year. This year is 1992. The man who came up with this madcap invention is Kieran McGuinness. So, Kieran, let's talk about 1992 real quick before we introduce our guest.
What happened in 1992?
What happened in 92?
Okay, so, Bill Clinton became the president of, I think it says America. Prince Charles, Diana, they separated. Do you remember them? Prince Charles.
And oui.
Bosnia and Herzegovina. Independent
as well. Yeah.
Am I going too into randomness?
No.
Films: Reservoir Dogs, Wayne's World, Basic Instinct, Sister Act. Yeah. Best act. best film: Silence of the Lambs. And so the big albums of the year were Automatic for the People, R.E.M., Pavement, Slanted, Enchanted, Sonic Youth, Dirty, Beastie Boys, Check Your Head, things like that. The Chronic by Dr. Dre, and the big song of the year, I Will Always Love You by Whitney Houston. So that's the sort of
that's musical. A big year. Yeah. That's a big pop culture year.
Yeah. Oh, the first reality show as well, MTV's Real World, and wow. Windows 3.1. Sorry, I'm getting a bit too nervous. Sinead O'Connor ripped up a picture of the Pope on TV.
Oh my God!
Fight the real battle. Yeah, 1992. Yeah.
Sinead.
And that was incredible.
And Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Okay, I should probably introduce our guest now, seeing as they made themselves known. The man reacting there with such shock about Sinead O'Connor is, of course, Conal O'Bracken. Bracken, I can never finish his surname, sir, from Week of Corners.
Hello.
Hello.
Bracken.
Bracken. Brack off.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
That was a real moment.
Let's close it there.
Welcome to the show, sir. We've had you on No Encore before, so welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you. Mary Kay Geraghty.
Well, who am I now?
A Fight Like Apes.
Am I, though?
And Live La Galaxy fame.
Yes.
And various other things in the world is in the studio.
Here I am.
How you doing?
I just wanted to say that I just thought that Daniel O'Donnell and Linda Martin were deserving of a nod from 92 as well.
What did they do?
Why Me?
Oh, shit. Daniel O'Donnell?
Daniel O'Donnell did I Just Want to Dance With You.
Oh sorry. Okay.
In 92, and Linda Martin won the Eurovision with Why Me in 92.
Was that in 92?
I hope so, because I've just said it.
The only reason is like, I was in primary school, and it's funny because I'm looking at the like R.E.M. album, and I love that album, and it's just funny how I obviously had to kind of go back to it. I had to revisit it, if you will, to kind of
so many jokes this evening.
Yeah, indeed.
But, hilarious.
But you know what? It's funny. Yeah, I just because I kind of feel like I remember that, but I would have been so young to remember it. You know. But anyway,
Yeah.
You're supposed to now, mate. You know, young man, 92. Well, then she's her final guest. Her final guest is Brian Mooney, a legend of the Irish music scene, of such people as The Idiots, David Kitt, Jape, you name it.
Legend.
How are you? Great. How's that feel?
That feels great. Just Sinead O'Connor ripping stuff up. Has anyone heard the Pussy Riot latest song?
Yes, she gets a mention in that.
Yeah, do you know the line?
I'm not going to quote it verbatim because I'll get it wrong. Do you?
Paraphrase, Dave.
It's something to do with Sinead O'Connor's vagina.
I rip shit up like Sinead O'Connor. I wear my vag like a badge of honour.
There you go.
Wow. That's very nice.
It's shocking.
That's Pussy Riot's new song.
Pussy Riot, yeah. It's Pussy. Wow. Where are you from? Vagina.
Brilliant. I love it.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's been like we're all...
It's almost the formula of any song I've ever written has been just like ting, 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 curse word. Ting, 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 curse word, ting, 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 curse word, curse, curse.
I think it's got a good, important message, though, you know.
It's called Straight Out of Vagina. We covered it on No Encore, actually, and I think the three of us, the three lads talking about it, all felt very kind of demure and bashful as we went through it. For, you know, professional music critics that we are. But, Pussy Riot weren't around in 1992, but we tend to go back on these Irish albums. We get them down to five after lots of shouting via email. And this, Kieran, was probably the most mixed of bags that we've had so far.
Yeah, it was kind of the first thing was there was a lot of albums. There was a big pile, but there was also a lot of albums that I just could not find. There was eight albums on the list of 20 that I couldn't find. I did everything to find. I even went into the illegal dark web and I couldn't find it.
Did you?
Well, I just, you know, looked at mad Russian sites that have mad Russian albums.
You're probably on someone's some police list now.
I probably am. Yeah, it's more
I better
to do
say,
with
what
my,
was
my
that
views,
outside when we were coming into the building? Anyway.
Yeah. But I actually had to contact members. Like, I had to contact The Stunning to ask him to email the album to me. But then he was saying that the album is actually deleted because of some messing they're having with the label. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
It's amazing people can do that now as well. I didn't even know people could actually completely delete an album.
I don't think you can as much now, but you could from 1992, I suppose, if you deleted it then. But it's mad because I kind of would have thought albums from the 90s would just be online somewhere, you know, because, you know, they would be in people's record collections, there would be people on people's iTunes, there would be favourite albums of people, and they would stay somewhere on the internet. But it's crazy, you know, I couldn't find anything, you know. But of the ones that we chose, it was pretty mixed baggy. Like, for example, there's a lot of kind of indie rock, you know, like lads singing indie rock, which is great, you know, nothing wrong with that. But
of course not, Kieran. Yes.
Of De Laurentiis fame.
Indeed. But it was also there's a lot of samey stuff in there. And when it came down to my choices, there was a couple that were kind of around the same. And the reason I didn't choose some of them, for example, Something Happens was one of the ones I was going to choose. And while the album is good, there was already a lot of lads singing indie rock on the shortlist, so I didn't put it forward. I put forward the In Dust album, but I suppose you're going to go through the final five.
I shall, yeah. Something Happens didn't make it, which was kind of on my initial shortlist as well, but in the end I was like, this is all about U2, that kind of era, and I was more intrigued by the one that I'm going with in this. The shortlist is Frankenwalters with Trains, Boats and Planes, Engine Alley with Sonic Holiday, Whipping Boy with Submarine, In Dust with Nosebleed, and Into Paradise with Down All the Days. So we shall start with you, Kieran, and Engine Alley. Others call her Mother Hubbard. Every evening at 10 o'clock, she takes a trowel and a secretaire. She's pruning roses and tripping hedges, even after 30. Sonic Holiday. Kieran, this was one of the ones that we went through, and I have to say I found it a bit of a struggle.
Oh, really?
A little bit. Yeah, I might have tapped out before the end of the entire album, which is a horrible thing to admit.
Well, I have to say, I mean, one thing which is kind of clear about this is it's 18 songs long, which is a double album, basically.
Did they call it a double album? No.
Well, the thing about it is, I guess 92 is the start of CD, so, I mean, it would have been a record, it would have been a double album, but...
Yeah.
18 songs. I think maybe it does start to... It would have been an amazing 10-track album. Well, I think it's a really good 18-track album. But anyway, so I don't know. First of all, I know nothing about any of these bands apart from Whipping Boy. Obviously, I know they're Heartworm later on, but you know, this list, I just didn't know any of the albums on it, and I kind of came to the mall with, I suppose, sort of fresh ears because I didn't really know what to expect, and I hadn't really heard of Engine Alley, and the front cover is all them wearing, like, you know, leather and shiny spandex and stuff and loads of makeup, and I just feared the worst, and I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was a really, really good album. I thought it was really interesting kind of pop. I thought it had really good melodies. I thought there was lots of stuff like, you know, Prefab Sprout and like kind of clever kind of stuff in it. And they kind of inhabit their own world. So they're a five-piece band and based, they're from Kilkenny, I think, and based around Canis and Brian Keneally. And they were signed to, I think, Sony. And they had a big record deal and, you know, there was obviously money behind them, but it's just a really good album. There's just lots and lots of really interesting stuff on it. It's quirky, it's a bit weird, it seems to be quite English. It also, as I said, it kind of managed to be in its own world a lot, which is kind of interesting. And I saw, so some of the songs, Mrs. Winder is one of the songs on it, and I listened to the album loads, and I went through watching videos and stuff. And there's a video then playing on Kenny Live, and it is the squarest thing you'll ever see in your life. It's like, Pat Kenny's like, these guys are really
Pat
rocking
Kenny up. Wasn't square, was he?
No, but it's just couldn't like, it's so it. Official, you know? And it was obviously really earlier in their career, because he kind of just gives them a biography before he introduces them. And then they come out, and they look kind of ridiculous. They're all in kind of makeup, but not like cool Bowie, I don't give a shit makeup, and kind of like lads from Kilkenny who are wearing makeup, but it's also kind of a bit lame, but it's also really cool. And they have this really smoking hot, you know, girl playing drums, and I don't know, just something about it that just did, like, it makes it really cool. It's just they didn't give a shit or something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I worked for Hot Press, they would kind of come up in conversation every now and then, even if it was like a talk about a revival or a new reissue or something. And I remember, like, the talk around the office was generally like, you know, this band could have made it if they really wanted to apply themselves that way, but they seemed to be happy doing what they were doing, which I don't know if that's dismissive and patronizing or if it's actually the case. I don't know if it's like, if that's fair, but I would say on a musical front, I found it to be quite overbearing. I thought, okay, the vocals in particular were quite, you know, like, this is...
There's a bit of American...
I see how somebody would love this, but I'm... Yeah, nah.
And there's a bit of English in the accent. The accent goes all over the place.
It really does, yeah. I think it goes beyond flamboyant into just plain irritating. But.
Boom.
I think, wow. Yeah, I was about to say, you're kind of describing a lot of my favourite and least favourite stuff of all time. So,
I'll leave now, so...
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind. There's definitely some Beatles vibes in there, which I, of course, shouldn't bring up, Dave, but there's some harmonies in there that are really... I think really interesting, like they, like, out of nowhere in the middle of something I think is about to be a little bit boring, they actually, there's a little bit of beauty in there somewhere. They have that beautiful song, Song for Someone. Steve Lillywhite, who was recording that record, was married to Kirsty MacColl at the time, and she's doing the backing vocals on the track. And
no, it's because in the video, I was wondering, in the video, it's the drummer.
Yeah.
Oh, makes sense.
Yeah, so on the recording, it's her, and I think, like, you saying, Dave, you saying, like, the 18 track you pieced out before the end. Of course you did. It's 18 tracks. But for the UK and US release, they were asked to rejig and rebrand. And it wasn't called A Sonic Holiday. It was called Engine Alley, the album was. So they weren't allowed to actually, of course, like, 18 tracks. I mean, I would like to for bands to have more freedom and do whatever they want. And I feel like we can, or any of us in the room can. But 18 tracks is a bit...
Well,
excessive, no? Plus, I'd be thinking, we can get 2 years out of that.
The same year was Generation Terrorist by Manic Street Preachers, 1992. Not 1990, 1902. But,
we got it.
Yeah, it's fine. Leave that in. It's gold. Yeah. But, 92,
and cut back into now.
And yeah, so I think it's just like that ambition thing. And it's funny, a lot of the albums on the list are first albums, which is an unusual one, apart from Into Paradise, which is a second album. But there's something about a first album where, you know, there's less kind of craft and there's less kind of maybe like you learn skill in a first album. A first album is a lot about like your ideas and your instincts and, you know, this thing of you can do whatever you want and it's your first album. And so that's what happens. I think you just go, let's do another track. This one's also as good as the last one. And you end up with 18 songs. But I do think you can forgive that a little bit. I think if it was their fifth album and there was 18 tracks but they all sounded the same, you'd be like, oh, you should know better than that. But
there's a lyric that kind of says exactly what you're saying. In the song Infamy, which I think is an amazing song, he does say, infamy, you've got it in for me. And I think, deadly. Yeah, you know, you nailed it. You found something in there and you went with it and it was good. Yeah. God.
That is a great song. And one of the things I liked about
it is amazing.
And the album is that the song structures are all over the place. Like that song, Infamy, it goes into, like, has a chorus, then it kind of goes into a kind of a bridgey bit of instrumental, and then it goes into another tiny little bit of bridgey bit of instrumental. Then, you know, it's just.
And they're a bit too poppy for that, I guess.
Yeah, but also, like, it's like they're going, whoa, why shouldn't we? Huh?
Yeah.
You know, why have another chorus? You know, and there's loads of that throughout the album where they, you know, they change speed near the end of a song.
I have to confess, I knew very little about many of these records before, and Engine Alley, I knew, like, virtually nothing about. But it's when I first listened to it, like, it was so different to, like, sonically and in terms of the palette that they were drawing on, the instrumentation, the orchestration with the strings, who, like, having read up on them, they're the classically trained violinist, Kenneth Rice. And it was so, they were, it was just so, such a creative use of different sounds, whereas the rest of the records around that time seemed to be a bit like meat and two veg. I found it a bit tiring after a while listening to the other ones. They all seem to sort of plow a similar furrow sonically, whereas this one, maybe the Industrial one was slightly different, but with this one they were just all over the place, and I thought in a great way. I think there was instruments there that I couldn't even recognise or identify, and the way they introed songs and outroed songs and segued songs from one to the other, it was just like nothing else I felt on the list. Probably too long in 18 songs for sure, but I just thought it was really, like, you know, listening to or looking at the title, A Sonic Holiday, for me it was almost like, it was like going loads of different places, and that for me made this record really interesting. I feel I'd like to give it even more time because I only managed to listen to it just a couple of times, but I thought it was great actually.
I think it's actually interesting because you mentioned that they re-released it under a different name. I must actually look for that one because maybe that's like a 10-track album.
I'd say it's probably just the album cut in half. Like literally just someone, like, you know, the manatees in the episode of South Park where they talk about the Family Guy storylines.
Yeah.
I'd say probably they just did that. They put the ages on into a tank and just went, lads, you just kind of all them. None of us love or hate any of them enough to kick them out, so we'll just do it this way. You know, I'd say that basically is what it was. And that can be pretty disheartening for a band as well, you know, if you're made to boil it down that way. But no, but I think you're completely right, though. I think actually the point you made about the title of the album, A Sonic Holiday.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Sonic Nightmare, I thought. Brian, what's your take on...
I didn't really know Engine Alley at the time. I saw them play, like, Trinity Ball towards the end or something like that. The album, I don't know, it was all just a bit too... I'm kind of with you, Dave. It's all a bit too chirpy and wacky for me, you know? I couldn't really get through it either, to be honest.
I'm fascinated by this time period, though, in general, because, you know, you got the hangover of the 80s and all the excesses of that, and it's kind of like, how did bands adapt to it, and did some of them rebel against it? In the case of this one, I kind of think it does a bit of both, really. I mean, I agree with what you were saying, Conal, in that, like, it is, if you look at some of the palette of other records that were on this, and even the long list of this, there is a lot of samey stuff, and I totally admire ambition. I totally appreciate when a band does something a bit different, as we'll see when we get to In Dust in particular. But I just, my patience ran out. And with that, we'll move on to the next one, which I believe is Cunnell's choice.
That's me, is it? Cool.
We're going to go Into Paradise, Down All the Days, and we'll have a little snippet of that now.
Right, well, a total change from the Engine Alley record is the Into Paradise record. I gravitated towards this primarily, or first of all, because we recorded our first record with a guy called Jimmy Eadie, who is the guitarist in Into Paradise. And Jimmy's a very interesting character. We worked with him for probably about a year, and only after about 9 months did we discover he was ever in a band. Usually that's one of the first things that you're kind of told when you're working with someone like that. But he had like looked at a couple of bits around the time when we worked with him, but hadn't really delved too much into them. But on listening to this record, that's so I picked it first of all because of that connection. First listen, I kind of thought, oh no, what have I done? Why? Because I thought it was so dark, to be honest. I thought it was, like, in terms of Engine Alley and in terms of what everything you probably hate about that, you'd probably love about a record like this. But it took me probably 4 listens before it. You know, you break through that point where it's actually kind of, you're finding it difficult to engage with this record. And it was like, right, I'm able to enjoy this now. I'm able to go back to certain songs that I love. But it's an interesting, like, I think their story is quite interesting. And Brian, who's sitting here to my right, would know an awful lot more about their story than I do, because Brian was virtually in the band Into Paradise. But so feel free to hop in at any point, right?
I think it was a no interrupting.
But they were formed in Dublin in 1986, initially called Backwards Into Paradise, and they released their debut EP Blue Light in 1989. On the Satanta label. Now, the Satanta label is an interesting one. I think it was quite an influential Irish label back then. And they also released the Frank and Walters EPs. So what they did, what Satanta would generally do kind of at the time was they'd sign these bands and they'd record EPs with these bands and then they'd move them on to bigger, usually major labels. And I think that's what happened with the Franks. And that's certainly what happened in Into Paradise's case. They released their first full length Underwater, but then they signed to Chrysalis and Enzyme, so they had their major label debut with their next album Churchtown. But after Churchtown, and this is where it gets very relevant to what we're talking about, is they got dropped, and which is pretty common, I think, at the time. And this was kind of recorded on the back of that, so they had been dropped. They were in a pretty dark space, as far as I know. I texted Jimmy, who was in the band, and I said to him, "Have you got any insights in this, just to help me get kind of into the record over there, whatever?" And Jimmy texts me back, which is just, I think, brilliant. He just seems to sum up the time in such a succinct way. So the album was written while we were living in West Cork in a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. We nearly killed each other during that period. We fell out badly and ignored each other in the wilderness for many months. We drank heavily and got very moody. We left the farmhouse and went back to London to our studio, where we recorded our first record. We'd been dropped and we were all very depressed. That sets the backdrop for where this record, I think, was coming from. Yeah. And it's apparent when you listen to it, for me anyway, it was a very, very dark record. It's kind of, their sound is kind of languid, kind of downbeat, seem to articulate maybe the angst and ennui of the sort of 90s suburban kind of life. The songs are these bass drenched, very bass heavy, sort of echoing the Bunnymen, Joy Division, bass drenched kind of sonic, desolate sonic soundscapes. There is a tension maybe between what appears to be an attempt at the start, like if you listen to the first couple of records, where there's these kind of, they seem to be trying to be positive kind of songs. Like it opens with "Tomorrow will bring something new. Tomorrow will say something good." The record then proceeds, and the final track is like, "There is no tomorrow." Yeah. It's like, yeah, that's one of the lines in it. Yeah. It seems to be like a battle between Dave Long, the singer, who starts out as if like we need to make this a positive thing, and is gradually worn away by the time he gets to the last track.
Say in the middle, in sleep, yeah, he says, "I can't believe anymore. I don't believe anymore." And that's in the middle.
So it's like that, by that stage, it's like, right, they're kind of done. They've been beat. Yeah. But it's, as I said, like it's very. I mean, Dave Long's a big U2 fan, and I guess U2's influence, particularly at this time, probably can't be overlooked on all of these. As you said, Dave, maybe people kicking against him, which I know the Franks would very much have been kicking against the U2 thing, but I know Dave Long would have been a big fan, and this would have been sort of the post-Octung Baby, which is like one of the biggest
but
albums at the time.
Post-Loveless, and I think there's a shitload of My Bloody Valentine in this as well.
I kind of resent their nod to Joy Division. The lyrics, I mean, certainly bass there's a lot of stuff in it musically that's not a Joy Division. Mm. For me, when it first opens up, I could hear The Cure. I could actually hear a bit of Frank and Waters. I'm not saying, sorry, timeline-wise, the Franks couldn't have influenced them, but I just mean I could hear that in it relative to what we were listening to for this show. But lyrically, which is where The Cure and Joy Division are in my heart, I couldn't have put them anywhere near Joy Division. I mean, in terms of themes and feeling and everything, lyrically, this album, Day and All the Days, I don't like it. I actually don't.
I have to say, lyrically, I think this is atmospheric, which is brilliant. I think it's really interesting, and I think it really sucks you in. But lyrically, I just think it doesn't have the... It's just not... like dexterous, it isn't
but
deep.
But it's nowhere as deep as the music.
If this was
an instrumental album, I would probably have put it in my final choice of album for tonight. But because of the lyrics, and I really actually hate saying that, and the idea that the band would hear me saying that, I would personally hate and nothing more than to hear someone destroy my lyrics.
They're over it now, though.
Well, it's still, like, you know what I mean. But Brian, yeah.
But honestly, I think that even at this time, they knew that their number was up, even by this record, you know. Obviously, they'd been dropped by the major and whatever that brings. But I know that, well, I feel that they themselves would probably think that they weren't all gems, you know, and it's only 8 songs and it's 33 minutes long, do you know, and
I appreciated that,
I could get through this and I couldn't get through the Enginali 18, but the thing is that there's a few songs that stick out on this as real gems, and then there's other ones that whatever the opposite for that is, you know what I mean?
Meg.
Meg. It's Meg, is it? Yeah.
Stinker Beside Love. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I thought, really, I quite like Love. No, I totally get what you're saying.
I did think that the first song, is that the first song? Must Get Better?
Must Get Better.
Tomorrow's the first song.
I thought it was absolutely, the atmosphere that was created, but that was amazing, you know? And Sleep, I think, is brilliant.
Yeah, Sleep is the one. Yeah. It's on it, you know. Yeah. Really.
Did anybody hear a comparison between Cheap Trick, I Want You to Want Me, and the... They have like a slow... To Want Me. Okay, look, I'll just throw it out there. For the listeners, maybe not you guys. Maybe the listeners will pay more attention to that little nifty comparison.
We'll do a split and have them run side by side. I like the kind of like the almost kind of combative like result here between the four of you, because I think it is. I think everything that everyone has said is completely spot on, and I think it's a very interesting document of where this band were at the time. But like sonically, it is difficult. I think it is tricky to get through, and I mean, no one wants to look back and be like, you know, oh, it's amazing to have this thing which is almost a catalogue of a band essentially disintegrating, but. From a fucking dickhead music journalist point of view, that is fascinating, and like, you know, it, you know, like you like to have these kind of things in the archive of music in general, even if it was a harrowing and horrific experience for the band and resulted in a record that, you know, probably doesn't get a lot of plays perhaps even by them. But yeah, so I find this more of a fascinating kind of thing than a cohesive record. I mean, and I love the honesty about it, and you know, sorry guys if you're listening for what you all went through. It didn't sound like a fun time out in those wildernesses. But yeah, I mean, again, this is like two records in a row where it's like, for very, very different reasons, I found them quite difficult to kind of get through. But, and it is kind of fascinating, Brian, as you were kind of saying, like, you know, you have an 18-track record followed by an 8-track record here. And like, even though it's like, you know, it's like the guts of a half an hour and change, it can weigh quite heavily on you because of what's going on. And I actually felt that way about the next record that we're going to talk about as well. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, it's a fascinating one, but definitely a complete weird one.
No, I found there was no sincerity in the lyrics. Yeah. And again, I feel as if I'm always, because we've all been battered online, I'm sure, with a song here and there that we've released. And I hate saying this because I'm sure there was sincerity in it. I couldn't catch on to any emotion in any of the songs based on the lyrics. Musically, I was with them the whole way.
You absolutely are nailing what I thought. It's the exact same.
You know, it's hard for me to hear you say that. But I understand it completely.
So you know, you played keyboard, is that right?
I just played keyboards on a few tours with them.
Later than this?
Yeah. Before that, for the Churchtown tour and this one, a few around the UK in the snow, in like all those toilets.
Were you there when Jimmy knocked Tom York out cold?
No, before that, yeah.
What's this?
That's a true. That is like one of those things again. Jimmy, after months of like working with him, he drops this bomb, and
we always kind of thought maybe that was why Tom's eye is gone.
Yeah, right. But apparently, he was going up. Jimmy, they were opening for Radiohead, and
no way,
yes,
and Into Paradise. World.
Yes,
amazing.
And Jimmy,
I'm not as good as a researcher as I thought.
Jimmy apparently, obviously, would have had a huge like rack of pedals and stuff and all sorts of gear with him, because he was really into, and that's really apparent, as you can tell on the record, he's really into sounds and creating soundscapes and things with his guitar effects and stuff. But he had a huge thing, and I think he said he was
coming off the stage, and there was
steps up onto the back of the stage, if you will, and Jimmy like turned himself around 360 to, and there was someone coming up the steps at the same time, and it was Tom York. He clocked him in the head, knocked him out cold. Like totally cold, and he had took a few minutes for him to come around, and eventually he did. But it's a great story.
Him and the manager.
It's a great story.
And he woke up and wrote the whole of OK Computer.
yeah, exactly. Go on, Jimmy.
In one glorious night. Okay, well, look, we'll move on to an album that's a real ray of sunshine by comparison. This is In Dust, and the appropriately titled Nosebleed. So In Dust, Nosebleed. As a big fan of Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, obviously I quite enjoyed this. This album's fucking crazy. It's absolutely bizarre. It's completely off the wall. Where do you even start? I'd say there's a massive, massive Nine Inch Nails vibe, particularly of that kind of Pretty Hate Machine and broken style of production and arrangements. This, when I was listening to it, like all I could think about was that video game Doom. Like, which is a, you know, I'm not much of a hardcore gamer or anything, but like I think everyone's had a, you know, had a go of Doom, revolutionary first person shooter at the time, fun game to play, and part of the reason is because it was just so relentless and fast, and its aesthetic was crazy, and part of its aesthetic was its music. Like, it was all these kind of like, you know, 8-bit kind of chiptune like metal songs, yeah, condensed with these chugging guitar riffs and just like ridiculous drums and like wacky solos out of nowhere, and it completely worked for that kind of relentless experience that you were going through. And everything about this album made me think of this, including the artwork. Like, I mean, it just seems to be incredibly of its time in that kind of a way. There's nothing here even approaching a chorus on any of the tracks.
No, and the songs go through different cycles and stuff.
Big time, yeah. I mean, like even my notes here are scattershot. Like, I mean, it's like the kind of thing you'd expect to hear on Sega Mega Drive. It's got discordant vocals, weird vocal samples. It's like an industrial art installation. It's goes to really fucking weird places. Like, the fourth track would fit right in with the kind of current revival or slash homage of 1980s horror movies, like The Guest and It Follows. It evokes that kind of sense of mood like John Carpenter did with his scores. Yeah. Of course, that's immediately followed by what sounds like a literal nightmare and the kind of thing that Gwar or Mr. Bungle would have put out.
What's the song? They Must Be Leopards. I said, They Must Be Leopards sounds like actual hell.
If you're into that type of thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy, and it melts your head. Like, I mean, like if you're listening to it with headphones on, like, you know, you gotta take a break. I mean, even before it comes, like, it's only 8 tracks, and like, but like some of them are like quite long. And yeah, this is probably the most bizarre record that we've done on this kind of like experiment thing that we're doing here. And I mean, I'm not gonna listen to it every day or anything, but it completely turned my head in the best kind of ways. And it's just all over the place. It's an absolute mess, but a compelling mess.
Sickner in a Sector. Mm. That's, I think that was incredible.
That's the John Carpenter one.
Oh my God. It was just such a, it was almost like Steve Reich or Philip Glass or something. Yeah. It was like classical in that sort of way. And it was such a breath of fresh air. On the, you know, this like whatever, palate cleanser or whatever that was so desperately needed at the time. But I thought it was genius.
A sorbet, if you will. Yeah.
But like, I think there's really clever stuff on it as well. The song Legal Speed, which I think is the third or fourth song. I never have the track list.
I think it's the third song. Yeah. I think it comes before, because that one that Colin just mentioned comes along and breaks it up. Yeah. And you're like, oh, great, because I can breathe again.
But Legal Speed, like the way that the beats kind of build up through the songs. And by that song, it's full on the heaviest drums they can possibly play. And it's augmented by beats. But it's kind of like, that's what people are doing now, you know. And Ministry released an album this year as well. And like, I probably not that far away from Ministry. It yeah. sounds like really early without, obviously, this kind of techno parts. Like, it sounds like really early, you know, Therapy.
You sure?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny.
It sounds like fucking Typo Negative at points. Like,
it's so weird. But the thing about it is
stacks
like,
and layers of, like, I just chugging guitar.
I just don't like
to explode. I know where to start.
I don't normally listen to this kind of stuff.
I don't listen to this kind of stuff.
This noise.
This is one of my notes, right? Kind of sounds like the music.
Kieran McGuinness.
Live quotes.
Kind of sounds like the music of if a load of squares went into a fetish club in a film. You know, if they all went in and the music was like, they'd be like, man, I don't think I like this. You know, it's like, it sounds like so extreme in that way at times. But the thing about it is,
De Laurentiis Holiday, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. What's this music? Why are they not wearing pants? Yeah.
I'm upset now. I'm very upset.
But the thing is that there is a lot of that, you know, shitty metal riffing, which is kind of boring.
It's never boring, Kieran.
But every now and again, they get into this groove and it seems to be augmented by keyboards and it's like, you don't know what the sound is, and it's brilliant, like, you know, and it really, and sometimes those bits don't last that long. Like the second song, after the breakdown part of the first track, which is Boredom Result, after there's a breakdown part in that, and when it comes back in again, it's like at this totally different kind of groove. And I could have listened to that for a little bit longer than I did.
Mary, you're very agitated over there.
I'm extremely agitated. I actually, as soon as I started listening to this record, I wanted to ring Kieran and Dave and thank them for bringing this to my attention. I was so overwhelmed with happiness and excitement with this album. I can't get over it. So these guys from Northern Ireland, anytime I've played in Northern Ireland with my band, I have always felt slightly intimidated by how heavy Nordy bands are. There's a heft to Nordy bands that we don't actually have in Dublin, Cork, Galway. Don't eat me over that. All I'm saying is, in general, right? In general, we don't. With this record, it's exactly what happy, exciting, amazing music is to me. There'd be nobody scoring lads in the room. Nobody. Because you'd be knocking people's teeth and heads out the whole time. You would just be jumping around. Like, even when you're talking about the fact that there's so much going on in it, it's like the captain of a ship. He still knows what's going on, you know? Throughout this record, I couldn't even take notes. I seem to have even blacked out some notes on the thing there, but I couldn't even take notes. I was actually just like, how have I never heard of this band before? And even trying to research them online was pretty difficult. There's a really I'm an expert on nosebleeds now.
It's like,
an expert on nosebleeds. Yeah.
It's just causing your nosebleeds?
There's a really
funny...
But I got this from irishmusic.org, and it's a really funny thing where he said, among the confused online descriptions of this band, you will find electronic pop with arrangements and rhythms whose sophistication vaults over any obvious goths at EBM influence is a flamboyant metal influence guitar action. It's a mix of electronic post-punk dark pop, but sometimes dramatic and nearly pompous, sometimes quirky though, and some death metal style solos and tremolo art abuse, and also kind of like Depeche Mode. But that kind of summarizes, like, for me, I didn't even have to go near, even in terms of reviewing this album, for me, I actually don't need to, you know, that made me extremely happy. The Nordy factor made me happy because it actually, talking about bands that I cut out of this, In Dust, as far as I can see, influence the generation after them. I think that for me is the reason I picked, and I'm so delighted with the final list. I think the five bands and those five albums have influenced a next generation. And certainly Nosebleed, I'm hearing. So, and they supported Whipping Boy as well when they did this album.
Boy and all that kind of yeah. It's interesting though as well because there's something about, like, as I said, I don't have a lot of metal albums, but I, like, you know, love early Metallica and all that kind of stuff. I've got loads of Therapy albums, but for this is just totally different, and it's so industrial. It's so like it's such a weird mix of techno and industrial and metal. It's just like bizarre, but I think it's really good.
You do,
but
keep
then
expecting
I found it too much.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can see that. Did you find it too much, Cole?
I did. I find this conversation so interesting, and the passion with which Mary Kate is talking about it.
I'll forgive you.
No. Yeah, do you know what? Like, it's just so interesting what people look for in like, my default is always you know, harmonic structure and melody and or, like arrangement, which is why the Enginelli thing would have pricked my interest. Whereas I can see your passion is coming from a different place, which is amazing. Like I need to go back and listen to that record with you've said in mind.
With me.
But it's why these sort of conversations are great. But yeah, for me, I just thought it was too much. Besides that palate cleanser in the middle, which I thought was beautiful, I thought that was incredible. But the rest of it, I was just like, oh, what are these lads?
Did you feel sad? I know a lot of people weird. When I talk about stuff like that go, just made me feel really sad and cold. Industrial seems cold, but
yeah.
Well, let's warm things up with the Frankenwalters, which is Mary Kate's choice or selection, and they sound like this. Trains, Boats and Planes, Mary. Trains, Boats and Planes.
Trains, Boats and Planes. So to bring it to a personal level for a moment, our first record label was FIFA Records, which is the Frankenwalters record label. Yeah. They were the only record label I've ever worked with that were made up of musicians and not business people. And that's, by the way, not at all to say, because it actually makes more sense to have it like at least 50-50 musicians and business people. But
can you say what FIFA stands for?
Football, Ireland football.
No, forever in financial arrears. Isn't that
yes.
Really?
Yeah, sorry, that was a joke, Brian.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but football, Ireland football. I knew it wasn't that.
Yeah, well, I was wondering. Football, Ireland football. I just couldn't wait to say it.
But it's totally correct. And we, one of my favourite moments ever on stage, and for our probably final shows with Fight Like Apes, we're going to cover Walter's Trip, which we played with the Frankenwalters in Cork and the Bowery before. Incredible song. And I think, like, it's a really good, for me and Connell's relationship, it's a really good album for me to say is I feel really jammy that it was on the list. It's one of my favourite albums of all time, without a shadow of a doubt, because a lot of stuff that I was listening to when I was about 18 and started getting into stuff that would end up shaping the music that I end up writing, like, you know, Metallica and stuff like that. Frankenwalters were one of those bands that were just infinitely positive with the way that they would write and the way they would play. Trivia, Brendan O'Connor was one of the drummers originally in the Frankenwalters. Everyone deal with that for a moment.
Brendan O'Connor,
the talk show host?
Guys, fuck precisely. Off. But I also just wanted to read out, just if you wouldn't mind, just for a minute, some of their lyrics. This is not a song about politics. It's not a song about sex. If you want, I'll talk about arrogance and if you're respectfully dressed. This song is not about rich or poor. It's about how we probably feel insecure. This is a song I wrote especially for you. I want to say thank you for having me too, because I'm glad to be here on this earth, living out all my dreams to their worth. And most of all, I love you all and I wish you well. And that is the same theme throughout that entire album, Trains, Boats and Planes. Top to bottom, they're not saying life is perfect. They're not saying life is pure or people are pure. It's nothing to do with that. It's just about having a positive in any way, no matter how difficult it can be sometimes, having a positive outlook on life and on people, in massive contrast to Nosebleed. So just, we can still hang out.
We can pivot.
Yeah.
I think you said that really well. The thing that I really thought about this album, I've actually never heard it before. I knew a couple of the songs of it. Obviously, After All, which is their big song, and This Is Not a Song, which is it's a gorgeous song, but there's something about that. It's just really not complex, you know, but in a good way. It's like it's simple, and they get to the point the whole time, you know, and I don't know. It's just like they kind of operate in a similar way to Sonica. They kind of operate in their own sort of world as well. They're writing this kind of upbeat, I think if I said simple, it would sound like I was being
negative. No, I think you're right. I think that's funny. You're trying to get around saying that, but you're right. Saying it's not complex is it's completely correct.
But in the kind of best way, like, it's just like they just get to the point and they don't care about it. And again, like, you know, there's lots of simple rhyming on it and stuff. But I don't mind that, you know, because I don't think you mind if the melodies are really good. The melodies are great in this.
That's,
you know,
the thing. The melodies are, that's what they really had, wasn't it? Those amazing sing-along melodies. And it was simple, but maybe certainly on some level. But also then I'd find that, like, the melodies, like the chorus would jump out completely where I would least expect it, you know. And I was also surprised how many songs I knew. I knew the titles of many of them. Yeah,
that one, the fashion,
New York crisis.
Crisis New York is a great title.
It's brilliant.
Yeah,
but like even a song like This Is Not a Song, it's like four choruses, four huge, incredible choruses. They could have had four killer tunes out of that one song.
Yeah.
Just so good. The sound of the record itself.
It's not, I was going to say, it's simple. It's not complex.
It's simple. Like. Yeah, yeah. Like I think Ian Brudy remixed the After All.
Yeah.
And that ended up going to like just outside the top 10 in the UK, I think. But I think the rest of the record sonically is a little bit maybe tinny for my like. I think the mix could have been done a little bit better. I think they worked with a guy called Edwin Collins, who they had done their first EP with.
Yeah, he was on Satanta as well.
And he was on Satanta. And Dave Cowse did their second EP, as far as I know. Right. Yeah. But anyway, I totally agree with the simplicity thing. And like, there's nothing more condescending than saying there's a naivety to the song, or something like that, or this is a songwriter who hadn't quite honed the craft of songwriting. But there is something to be said, I think, in relation to this record. And I think on Grand Parade, which followed, they really had nailed their thing. There was like a sophistication to what they were doing at that point. Whereas there is a slight simplicity to what they're doing here, but in the best way possible, and it gets you right.
But the
right
message
here,
it's like when everyone says, "I want to be an inventor," but the problem is you can't get simple enough to invent something simple that people actually want. The lyric in John and Sue, "There'll be somebody there for you, my friend." Deal with that. Like, that is perfect. That's talking to two people who are in love, or people who want to be in love, or people who want to just figure something out. There will be somebody there for you, my friend. There are times I get distracted by the ways and workings of this world, yet I think of you as my life's shrine and I'm glad that I'm yours. I could never write that because I cannot get out of my own head enough to go, that's so simple and gorgeous and beautiful. That's all you need to do. Is that?
I'm not a songwriter, but I think that I think that, like, you know, when it comes to lyrics and that kind of thing, I think conviction is what sells things like this. I think that, you know, 1,000 different writers could write those lines down on a page and be like, no, that's too simple, that's too simplistic, I'm not going to do it. I need to make this more complicated. I need to make people look for the subtext. But I think if you actually run with it and do it well, you know when someone has nailed it for the right reasons. And I think, you know, a different example would be like the Waterboys. So one of my favorite lyrics of all time is from Hole of the Moon, which is, "I spoke about wings, you just flew." And it's like, that's like eight words or whatever, and it just says every fucking thing. Mary has a tattoo of the Waterboys on a different lyric, but like that right there, like, that says everything about life and love and, you know, unrequited love and pain and everything, like, and the joyous aspects of life as well. And again, I think if I come up with that line, I'd probably go, no, it's not complicated enough. It needs to be bigger and more mysterious. And I think a band like the Franco Walters, like, I think part of what makes them kind of special is that there's a communal thing about them. They invite the listener in, and obviously they're known for having gigs which are very much like that. But even in their songwriting, I think a part of it is that you can kind of go, I relate to this, and I don't need it to be, you know, anything more than what it is. And again, that sounds almost condescending, and I don't mean for it to, because I mean, even like to come out with a line like, you know, well, the hardest thing a musician can learn is restraint, but like, but it kind of is.
I've said it now,
but I feel like, you know, it's very hard to apply that restraint and still come out with a really fucking good song, and they can do it, and that's, you know, hats off, or orange ties off to them.
Weren't you going to tell us something, Brian, about Satanta and the Frank and Walters a little while ago?
Just that they shared the same label as Into Paradise, the same time. So we were kind of following each other a lot around touring the UK at the time. And the Frank and Walters didn't drink, and Into Paradise did quite a lot. So it was quite a good relationship that they had. We'd drink their rider. That was what I was going to say.
But, but apparently they would have looked after themselves like very well. Like they would have taken care of themselves, and they're in great health now. Yeah. They would have been very canny with their with the money they would have made earlier on, which helped probably with their longevity in terms of, you know, they weren't burning themselves out.
They've just bought their whole back catalogue. They own all their records, all their recordings.
I think
now,
with their first advance, really they each bought a house.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Like with their first advance.
That's amazing.
And after show parties, we'll be back to the house.
Stop it! I went on the piss for 2 years.
I drank my house.
There's a lot of interior decorating goes into that kind of
don't
thing.
Don't be mean, Dave.
I'm not being mean. I'd love to interior decorate a house. It's great crack. But we'll move on to our final
quote
album.
Quote of the episode. I'd love to interior decorate a house.
The verb.
I used to renovate houses.
I interior decorate?
Very briefly for like a couple of summers. There's no better pleasure in the world than taking a sledgehammer to an old wardrobe. It's amazing.
You destroy things, basically.
Yeah, when I say interior decorate, I mean destroy, disintegrate, renovate.
I thought that's what it meant as well.
Yeah, see? Yeah. It's great. But and one album that you could listen to while smashing up a wardrobe with a sledgehammer is Submarine by Whipping Boy, which sounds like this.
You better know the words of this song now. In your white suburban yard.
Okay, Submarine, Whipping Boy. Anytime a kind of, you know, illustrious best Irish albums of all time poll comes out, it tends to be a different Whipping Boy album that ends up sometimes at the very, very top. Is this album overlooked in that regard, Brian?
For me, certainly. At the time that, and you're referring to Heartworm, the album after this, I was actually very disappointed in Heartworm, and I for me, that was... That was the end of Whipping Boy. I know that's a bit harsh, but the thing was that I used to do sound in a club called The Underground, and they used to play there quite a lot. And I did sound for them in a few other places as well. And I knew the songs on Submarine, and that was, and I knew them live. I just loved them. I loved the gigs. So when Heartworm came out, it was just a different thing. For me, it was a bit more produced than I would have liked. So for me, Whipping Boy was this album. That's just in answer to your question. But coming back to listen to this album was quite a thing for me, because I'm not just listening to the album. I'm directly back in 1991 in Temple Bar. You know, the start of STC, and this album was recorded in Sun by Aidan Foley, and like that just means straight away. That means like low budget. Like, I don't mean no offense to Aidan or Sun, but I just mean, you know, it was kind of earthy in that way about what was going on, certainly in my life, you know, and the scene, you know. And for me, this whole time this album really sums up a certain passion, you know. So it's incredible for me to think that Engin Ali's album was out at the same time, you know. Because
they do seem, you
know, it was completely different. This was my world, and I was totally just enveloped in this. You know, there were other bands around, like Roller Skate Skinny and stuff. But you'll hear obvious, you know, and you know, you'll see it all the time. Referring to this album, you'll see, you know, Jesus, Mary Chain, and Sonic Youth. But people used to throw out Sonic Youth as a reference to any band that had a distorted guitar anyway, you know. So, you know, I'm kind of always wary about comparisons. Stop that.
Did I kick something?
No, I was just going to. I was just saying, I'll cover up my Sonic Youth reference.
I'm always very wary about comparisons that can be easily used. And as a journalist, I'd say you have to use them. You know, you have to guide people or whatever.
I hate using comparisons.
Bands have to use them as well. That's the problem, though. You're going to have to say to somebody, Brian, in fairness, and I hate them as well. But someone, let's say from the US, a potential booker says to us, what do you sound like? I'm not going to say, come see for yourself. I'm like, no, we're not going to come see for ourselves, do you know? Yeah. But anyway, continue.
Yeah. You've got to give them the shorthand.
Well, I just mean, I think people
a that bit was more,
you could be a bit more careful about using, because they seem to be bandied about pretty easily, you know, that's all I mean. Mm-hmm. What was I going to say was that, having said that, listening back to this now, and it just became like, oh my God, the references jumped out like so easily. Yeah. Whereas at the time they didn't. Mm-hmm. At the time it's all new and exciting, and you know, but now listening to it, you can hear very clearly, you can hear the Fall and you can hear the Velvet Underground.
Yeah,
and, you know, and then listening over and over again, that didn't take away from it. And initially it was, I kind of saw that as like a small negative that you'd be, you know, so easily referencing these influences. But then when you listen over and over again and you just go with it and you just kind of tend to forget that and you get into the record. And something else that occurred to me about it, by the way, I just say, those underground, like I Wikipedia this, of course, you know, and you see all these things about Ferg being a mad, you know, cutting himself on stage and all that. There was a show element to it, but I can tell you that before every gig, he was like adjusting the lights, you know, focusing them, making sure everything was.
I'm very glad to hear that. I mean that
in the best possible way. Yeah. I mean, like, he was like attentive to the gig and the show, and you know, it wasn't just, you know, it was focused, and everything about them was focused, and the music was focused, and they were, you know, gentlemen, very, very nice, quiet guys, and then they'd plug in and they'd play and you could feel the air moving. You could do like when the bass started playing, boom, you know.
Have you seen them play recently, Brian?
No, it was in 2005. No.
The last time you saw them.
2006, I think.
We played with them in 2011.
Yeah, when they their first resurgence since the breakup in.
And it was so did we.
It was crazy. It was like the garden sessions down in the hotel in Offaly. What was the name of the hotel? The County Arms Hotel. It was like a charity kind of gig thing, but it was out in this kind of walled garden, kind of small enough. All the chairs, just like plastic chairs, lined up in a row, like facing the stage. And by the time they came on, there was about, I'd say, 20 people in the whole place.
No way.
And Fergal was like, incredible performance, but even with just 20 people there, he was like writhing around on the floor, like on his back, going under the chairs. It was incredible.
But that's the thing, he's not actually playing for, he's actually, it's something I think that a lot of us can tend to miss sometimes, when you kind of are, you're expecting, if you're listening to the noise around you and not the noise that you're actually making yourself, like you do actually forget that you should be doing this anyway. And if you give out before or after a show, you certainly don't make your protest during a show. You certainly don't stop playing or giving it everything during a show if there's not enough people there, you know?
We played with him and he dresses as a suicide bomber.
What is that dress like?
he dressed, as you can probably imagine. And he also lit the Irish Times on stage. He burnt the Irish Times on stage. And like,
why the Irish Times?
Fucking papers in the world. Come on, Fergal.
I think it was because they said something and he had it and he was just came out and started burning. I was like, this is amazing.
He did an interview actually recently, I think in 2011, during one of those shows, where he said, if you have a human voice, you'll never be forgotten. And it's all about just having a human tongue. And I actually thought that made a lot of sense. Think like, you know, when we all get caught in the din, especially like we're all of us here involved in bands, you know, you get caught up, and I don't care what anybody says, we all get caught up every now and again whether we let it continue or not, I don't know. But you do wonder, should I do that instead of that? Or maybe we should think about that. Maybe we should whatever. Whereas his point being, if you have a human voice, if you actually just talk, if you actually just say what it is that you want to say from your perspective, it can't be right or wrong. It's, you know, it's the only way really of making it, I think.
I'm not sure what other years you've covered in this series. And do you know if it's all pre-digital? Are they all pre-digital? Or
1980 to 2005.
To 2005, so, okay. So, bit, yeah. So, you know, around this time...
That's a pretty good span.
I was doing like a sound course in SDC, as I was saying, and I remember this guy called Barry Warner, and his name just popped up on this that he was released. Not, I can't remember what he did, but musically, but he came into the class one day with a sampler. It was called an Akai S1000, you know, and it's this. Do you know the Akai S1000?
No,
I was so dying to go. First time, yeah, I know.
First time we'd ever seen a sampler, you know, because we'd been doing tape loops. Like using a spool and a pencil, and the tape would go around the room like that, you know, and that's how you'd make a loop, and you edited it with the tape with the hardback razor, and you know, it was that's what recording was and editing was, and all these albums were recorded onto tape, you know. I think it's important to remember that. I just that, you know, this sampler, by the way, that Barry Warner brought in, massive fucking thing. And it could record, like it could sample a sound for up to 1.5 seconds. You know? And the way you use it is like just insane. The technology, it was like we spent weeks trying to work out how do you use this thing, you know. So in light of that being the kind of, you know, the landscape of recording at the time, yeah. And then listening back to this, and I just go, wow.
We're very tight for time, so I'll keep it brief and I'll say that I thought this was great.
Sorry,
Dave.
Sorry for talking.
No, it's fine. No, please. As the host, it's my job to sit back and let people talk. And I will say that I'm probably with Kieran, though. I think Heartworm might be the better record, but not by a massive degree. And it was very, very fun to go back and explore this, and it will be even more fun to listen to it now that I know that there was so much kind of incredibly, you know, analog and just raw labor that went into it. So, and I to be honest, I like the production differences. I mean, you kind of opened up by saying that you felt that Heartworm, I guess, was too clean, or signaled the end of the band, that you know, the kind of the really kind of DIY aspect, and I can totally see why that would be a thing. But I quite like both those aspects in general. But I think this is a great record. I think it deserves to stand on its own. We'll take a break and we'll come back and see who stands tallest this time. Right, I think this is going to be a tough one. I think it's been quite a mixed bag, as we said at the start of the episode, but in a very good way. And I think all the arguments are very, very compelling and correct. Kieran, we'll start with you.
Oh, shit.
didn't see that coming, did you?
God damn it.
All right, so I think for me, the album that I'm most... the album that I would recommend to people probably... Actually, no, I'm not sure. No, I'd probably say... I am sure. But I'm just saying,
musicians.
I'm going to have a sub. I'd say I would recommend people listen to... probably the Frank and Walters first, but I would also strongly recommend people listen to Engine Alley. So I will go for slightly more than a vote for Frank and Walters, slightly under a vote for Sonic Holiday.
Perfect. You're on. That was
good. Connell,
I would go for the Frank and Walters. Just for me, it does stand for me, in terms of songwriting, in terms of the type of lateral thinking that's gone into the lyrics, it stands head and shoulders for me.
Okay, Brian?
For me, it's Submarine, because it captures the time so well. If there was a time capsule, you know, that would be the one. But then again, that would be my one, because, you know, there was all this other stuff happening outside of my bubble. But Submarine for me.
Mary Kate is going to go with Frank and Walters.
I am. I suppose the only reason I would go for Nosebleed by In Dust is that I don't think a lot of people know about it, because I didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. So I think if anybody else was pushing for In Dust, Nosebleed, I'd probably have given them the vote, because I think it's really important if people listen to music they haven't listened to before. But considering I think we're going to win this, I'm going to stick with my boys.
Do you want to give a just under a vote for Nosebleed?
Well, that's a really bad system, Kieran. But yeah, sure. I'll give just over a vote for Frank and Walters and just under a vote for Nosebleed by In Dust.
Yeah, this is like it's extremely hard to pick. I kind of have like a three-way tie for first here with Nosebleed just about pipping it, but at the same time I really want to shout for Submarine because I think it deserves to be recognized, and I think Frank Walters, you know, like it's one that I'm totally happy to win. But I want to kind of represent and shout out for the other two. So I guess a two-way tie for first for me with Nosebleed and Submarine, which I guess leaves Frank and Walters as the overall winner.
Frank and Walters is the overall
winner. But just winner. About.
Just about. But just I think about.
Yes!
The reason that the other tracks, the other albums were in it is because, I guess it's because they were really good albums, you know, of the year. So.
Well, we picked the most mainstream, I think, which is kind of important note, I guess, is that between five people with varying music
It's an
interests.
Interesting process. Yeah, you end up kind of going with...
Yeah.
Kind of the one that will appeal to most.
But then I think Nosebleed and Submarine, I think, like, to be perfectly honest, before this, I haven't listened to either of those through. Even Submarine I know, and I've heard plenty of songs from it many times. I've never listened to it through. And I think it's really, anybody that's listening to this has to understand that there's five people sitting here, completely different walks of life, all... coming down to these other two.
When we were going through and listening to the long list, the Frank and Walters didn't stick out to me. It wasn't one of my long lists, you know, ones that I was pushing forward. But actually, when we refined the list and everyone's kind of votes came in for the ones, I ended up listening to the Frank and Walters quite a lot over the last, you know, couple of days. And, you know, it kind of came through in that way for me. Mm. So I'm kind of happy to kind of put it forward. I think... Yeah, I don't know. I think you're right about the mainstream nature of it, but I mean, in second place are two of the least mainstream.
Totally.
So, you know, and for example, if one of us had changed our vote there, it would have been, you know, a different thing. But
and even then, it's kind of one of the things where...
It takes one vote here on, though, isn't it? In the winner and the loser.
That's all, elections.
It's even one of those things where it's like, you know, it's like a star rating on an album review or a film review, ultimately. You know, like, I find that the words, the copy, to be more interesting. And I think that, you know, over the course of this episode, all five records have been given very equal footing in that regard. And I think, ultimately, the listener can make their own decision. Wow. And listen to Nosebleed. You should totally listen to Nosebleed, because it's really, really good. Right. Okay, so to play us out, we'll have a song from the winners, Frank and Walters. What song... Oh, sorry, I say thanks, everyone. By the way, sorry, I'm a terrible host. Thank you to Connell, to Brian, to Kieran, as always, and to Meike, who will decide what song plays us out.
She get to decide. I voted for her as well.
But her passion shone through.
Classic.
Classic Kieran McGuinness. Classic Kieran McGuinness. Gamesmanship.
From one of the greatest bands Ireland's ever produced, of Frank and Walters, this is After All.
All right, we'll see you next time. Woo-hoo.
Just before we play this episode out with a song from the Frank and Walters, Kieran actually got Ash from the band on the phone. So here's a quick interview with Ash from the Frank and Walters.
How you doing, Ash? This is Kieran here, and we're giving you a shout from the No Encore Revisit podcast. Trains, Boats and Planes was our album of 1992, the album that we're recommending people to revisit. So I just wanted to have a little chat about the album. How does that sound?
Yeah, no problem at all, no problem. We'd moved as a band, did our first gig in about 89, even though we'd kind of been going on and off for a bit before that. And we moved over to London in 91. It was just nothing going on in Ireland, really. There was no music industry, really, as such in Ireland. So it was just, you know, it was pointless. We reached the heights that we could reach in Cork, which was like the headline Sir Henry's. So we went off to London, got a deal with Satanta Records, which was a very, very small Irish label at the time. And then we released two EPs with them, and then we signed to a bigger independent called Go Discs. They were famous for bringing through bands like the House Martins and people like that, and Billy Bragg. And it's like when it came to doing our album, we were on our third EP, and it was, you know, like all bands, you think, no, it's time to make an album, and Trains, Boats and Planes was the result. We'd done some of the early EPs with Dave Cowse, who's this lead singer with A House.
Who
we would have been good friends with. And A House had used Edwin Collins for their album, that they had done in 92. So he was kind of working as a producer at the time, and it just, they finished their album and we started our album pretty much the following weekend with him. So it was yeah, it was kind of recorded in bits and bobs. We were doing a lot of touring at the time, so I kind of went in, did the drums, they went in, did the bass, and kind of did it in over the course of, I suppose, 3 months, kind of on and off. But I mean, the actual recording days, it was probably recorded in maybe 12 days and mixed in another about 5 days, which is quite quick for these days. It was recorded on 24-track tape, which meant that you would only, with the click track, you would only 23 tracks to work with. Yeah. So, for me, like, listening back to it and for the rest of the band, it's like, that's kind of the album where we learned how to make an album. We kind of feel that we didn't get it right till our second album, but people like it, people seem to love it. There's definitely a naivety about the record, and I think it was a friend of mine who just said the best. He said when he's listening to the songs, he kind of gets the feeling that anything could fall apart at any moment.
Yeah.
And he's right, because, you know, because we weren't used to being in a recording studio, we'd never made an album before, and we were literally coming off tour, running into a studio, trying to get as much done, and then going back on tour. And there was that element of spontaneity there and naivety there, which still kind of comes across to this day, I think. So
I think though it comes across, you know, it's kind of simple. Some ways, but not in a negative way, in a kind of way that it's clear, like it's incomplex, but it means that the melodies are very strong. And I think in a way it's a lot kind of more clever that way or something.
Yeah. I think it's one of these records where it's very hard for the band to have a view on it, which makes sense, because, you know, it was just such a blur for us at the time. I think you generally don't learn how to make an album till your second or third album, you know.
That's right.
As a band. But then you can't argue, you know, you can't argue with fans who, like, it was couple of years back, we went out and did the 20th anniversary of the record, and people loved it. People loved hearing them old songs. And I mean, you know, you'd know, like, certain songs, like After All, which would have been a hit in the UK at the time, and Fashion Crisis Hits New York, like the bigger songs on the record. Like, a lot of people would know, but there's kind of songs on the record that, you know, we had to relearn, like we'd kind of completely forgotten about. But people loved the songs, and we never rated those songs because they felt so almost amateurish to us. But then, like, you know, there is a certain beauty in not knowing what you're doing as well. At sometimes, even though it's not nice, you feel like you're kind of on a tightrope, kind of about to fall off the cliff or something. But people recognize that and they get a good feel from it. But I'm the same. Like, when I listen back, like, I suppose the bands that I would have been influenced by would be, like, you know, the Wedding Present stuff, and I still, like, go back to the early stuff where it is, like, it's just, like, the albums, as albums, are kind of train wrecks, you know what I mean? It's just 100 miles an hour, they're playing everything too fast. But that's what I like about it, that kind of, you know, just doing it because you something's in you and you got to get it out of you, and you got to get it out of you as fast as you can, you know? So
I think there is something, though. I think you talked about kind of a naivete or whatever. Like, it actually works really well. Like, songs, like, this is not a song. I mean, lyrically, it's quite direct, but it's still very connective, you know. It still connects in a way. I mean, how was that song written quickly, or generally were the songs written quickly, or were they crafted?
They would have been written very, very quickly at the time, and it was you know, like, generally, you know, if something wasn't working, because we were, you know, because we were very young and we were very impatient, if something wasn't working after, like, an hour in the practice room, it was just ditched. So, like, all the songs that you hear on that record, like, none of them really went through, like, any big process. It was just, they either worked or they didn't. The ones that worked stayed there. Then Edwin Collins came in as producer, and he was a very hands-off producer, in a way. It's like, if he felt something something was right, he'd let it go. He'd pipe up if he thought something could be added to it. But I think he wanted to capture what the band was at that moment, and he wanted to keep that simplicity in. I mean, he had been through the mill with major label stuff with his band Orange Juice, and then as a solo artist. And I think what he saw in us was this kind of simplicity and this like desire to kind of get to the finish line as quick as we could. And he recognised that was something that he had, but he lost. And I mean, once you kind of unlearn that, it's impossible. It's 100% impossible to go back, And like even we found that, like we made an album in around 2007, 2008, and like in a small way, we wanted to recreate our first album, and we couldn't. We just couldn't do it. We couldn't capture that. The way recording has gone, the way technology has gone. Now you've you can have 200 tracks if you want. It was just impossible to go back and do that kind of breakneck pop song where everything is so simple and all that's shining through is the melody and those direct lyrics. I mean, it was like even with This Is Not a Song, like there's a part in This Is Not a Song, which is, I mean, if you break it down into a structure, it's a very strange song. It goes kind of verse, bridge, chorus, bridge, second chorus. It's a nod structure. And when it got to that second chorus, it felt like there was no need more needs for any words. So like Paul, which he used to at the time, he used to just make up kind of lyrics on the spot, which didn't really mean anything. It was the same with Walter's Trip. The chorus of Walter's Trip, there's actually no lyrics. It's just words that sound good, that fit the melody, And I mean, you'd never do that now. I mean, the only other band who I can think of that do that are the Cocteau Twins. And, it was just, we had said everything we needed to say. So it was just, we went into gobbledygook mode, no problem. And we'd no problem doing it. And it just felt like, that was us. And, and Edwin, thank God, because it is a kind of a quirk of ours on that album. And particularly, I think there's three songs there's parts of the songs which there's no lyrics. It's just like gobbledygook. And Edwin left it. And I remember the A&R man at the time was going, you can't release a song like with gobbledygook. And, we were going, why not? And Edwin was backing us, which was great. So we had this big showdown with the label and, it was like, that's ourselves amazing. And the producer won, which was great.
It seems like something that it does seem like something from a past, especially
yeah
the way things are vetted now as well. But I think it's a brilliant album. It stood the test of time, and I guess when you look back at it now, are you proud of the album, or do you feel like, or do you listen to, are you one of the people who can't listen back to it?
It's hard when we did go back out and tour it. Obviously, we had to relearn it, so we had to go back to listen to it. Like there's certain songs that definitely stood the test of time, and I mean, After All is just one of them songs where we kind of got embarrassed about it for a while, but I mean, in the end, we just kind of succumbed to it. It seems to be on the radio, kind of it crops up every now and again, and it's like it's paid our mortgages for years, so we can't really complain about it anymore. But it's like that's a song that like it still sounds good on the radio. I think Fashion Crisis the same. This Is Not a Song. Daisy Chain sounds good, but there's a few cringe moments. But I think you're going to get down with every.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably a handful of bands that don't have. I'm thinking of maybe the Stone Roses' his first album, maybe the Killers' first album, where there is no kind of there is no.
Oh, they're
cringe moments. They were just touched by the hand of God and they just got it right. But there's definitely a few cringe moments on that for us. But it was like when we went out and we thought of like dropping a couple of songs for and doing some B-sides instead of the songs. But when we went out and played the album and the reaction it got, we kind of realized you know, and in a live setting, it was different. I mean, I think the studio versions, kind of, it is kind of warts and all. You can kind of hear bits that you're not 100% happy with. But, you know, live, the songs that we weren't happy with came to life, and they kind of took on another dimension. I think in the end, once we finished that tour, I mean, basically, the spent pretty much the whole year touring it all over. And by the time we came off the tour, we kind of grown to love the tracks again, you know, the tracks that we didn't have in such high esteem, we kind of learned to love them again, which was good. Like, but I mean, as I say, it as an album, it's hard to look back with it 100% with fondness. Yes, we'd be like proud of certain moments in it, but I think like we definitely learned how to make an album and how to bring people on a journey from A to B from making that album and from making mistakes on that album as well, you know. And like, I think that's the thing where I think maybe, you know, bands starting out now, because we've changed the way we listen to music, we tend to listen to individual track. And I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone. I'm not giving out about the way young people listen to music. When I listen to Spotify and I'm like, I'm bouncing around like DJs, it's like between different tracks and different bands and different genres and different time periods. It's like bands, I think bands have maybe, you know, they don't go out to make an album. They just put together a collection of songs. But, you know, there is a benefit of going back and seeing the way people made albums back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, whereas it was a starting point, a middle point, you know, and an end point. There was a story. And like, I think the mistake that we made with Chainsmokers and Planes, we definitely learned from, and in the subsequent albums we were able to kind of put right. So it's, I mean, all in all, we're proud of moments, but I mean, we're happy with the reaction it got, and we're kind of glad that it kind of shoved us in the right direction to kind of go and make subsequent albums. I mean, the follow-up album is actually 20 years old this year, so we'll be going out doing a few gigs around that. Like, we're kind of more happy with that album. It's kind of, it feels like a more rounded album. But, you know, I would imagine most fans would probably still have more of a soft spot for the first album, the Chainsmokers and Planes album. So, can't argue with the public.
This is it. You can't. The great and most. I guess you're still touring. You're still releasing albums. So, what are you up to right now?
Yeah, well, we just pretty much finished we had an album out there in April, the latest one, and just finished up in mid-November in the UK. So we've got a few bits and bobs in Europe with that, but we're kind of finished the UK and Ireland. We're kind of finished that tour. So we're in the middle of writing the next album, but it won't be out this year. We're talking 2018. And we'll do towards the end of the year, kind of September, October, we're going to do a few Grand Parade gigs, which was the second album. So we're going to do the 20th anniversary of that. So we're kind of gearing up for that at the moment, and kind of reissue it on vinyl and kind of a, you know, collector's pack. And, you know, people seem to enjoy that. Plus, it's a handy way to make a few quid to put in to the album that we're making next, you know.
That's what it's like
you're releasing albums and touring to make money to make the next album, yeah. Really. So, I know it's a nice cycle we're in at the moment. It's, you know, we're not killing it. I mean, myself and Paul, the two original members, Paul the singer, like, both of us are 50 this year, you know what I mean? So we can't, you know, we're not going to kill ourselves, like, but you know, it's nice to do short tours of places without actually, you know, going nuts and killing each other and stuff, like, so that's kind of the loose plan, is to finish up this album in Europe, the Grand Parade stuff, and all the while kind of, you know, like, get the bones of the next album recorded this year and get it finished early next year and mixed and kind of out for, I don't know, March or April 2018, I suppose. So,
Ash, thanks very much for chatting to us, and congratulations on a great album. And yeah, we encourage everyone to go and revisit it. Thanks very much. See you later.
Nice one. Thanks, Kieran. Talk to you later.
Thanks, man.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Celebrate this July 4th with a special presentation of A Capital 4th. Join your host, Vanessa Williams, with performances from sea to shining sea, starring Jimmy Buffett, Gladys Knight, Alan Jackson, Cynthia Erivo, Pentatonix, Renee Fleming, Train, Jennifer Nettles, Mickey Guyton, Jimmy Allen, Ali'i Cravalho, Laura Osnes, Ali Stroker, and the greatest live fireworks display in the USA. It's A Capital 4th, sponsored by the Boeing Company and American Airlines. Sunday, July 4th, 8, 7 Central. Only on PBS.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.